Coming up on Digital Music Trends 188, recorded on the 18th of June 2014, YouTube causes a stir with imminent independent music takedowns, Amazon enters the on-demand space with Prime Music, Spotify makes it easier for developers to build awesome web apps, BitTorrent bundles reach 100 million downloads and streams, Samsung integrates Spotify Connect with its new wireless speaker range, Deezer's latest round of funding, and a chat with merch company Sidestep. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Leonelli and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And DMT is available as an audio show as well as a video show, so you can find it pretty much everywhere on YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, iTunes of course, most podcatchers and TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, really you name it, you'll find it there. And if you want to receive a weekly mail out around the show and what we've done in any particular week, you can sign up on bit.ly/DMTlist. And of course, don't forget that you can send feedback via Twitter on @DigiMusicTrends or via email on contact@DigitalMusicTrends.com. And this week, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome two great guests. And for the first time, it's great to welcome Dan Koplowitz, the founder of Friendly Fire Recordings based in San Francisco. So hi, Dan, and thanks for joining me. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. And we met at the Great Escape, so it's great to connect again and have a chat with you on the show. And I'm also really happy to welcome back a long-standing guest of the show, Duncan Gere. Actually, I have to ask you, is it Gere or Gere? Because every time I ask myself, Gere, okay.
I ask myself, Richard Gere, but with an extra E.
I ask myself, and every time I feel like I'm doing an injustice. And who writes some amazing pieces on Wired and a bunch of other publications. And he writes about digital music, but also about the environment and weather-related topics, space-related topics, and so a wide variety there. And it's
anything anyone will pay me to write about, basically.
But it's so good to have you. It's so good to have you. And you've just finished your master's as well, which is awesome.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, I'm based in Sweden, and it's a beautiful summer here. We got midsummer coming up, not tomorrow, but the next day. It's going to be wonderful. And everyone dances around a big pole. It's great.
Yeah, exactly. And if you are interested in weather-related topics, your blog is Looking Up?
No, yeah, I've actually stopped doing Looking Up about 2 weeks ago. I probably should have mentioned that. But yeah, it's all still there, and it's all still great, so you should definitely go and read it. But there won't be any more coming up for the time being.
Right, but you can find everything on DuncanGere.com.
DuncanGere.com, exactly.
Perfect. Awesome. And so, you know, this week I was so determined not to start the show by talking about YouTube. I was like, this is not going to happen. I'm going to talk about something else, Amazon, anything. And then this happened yesterday with the Financial Times piece published by Robert Cookson, which contains quotes from Robert Kinsel, YouTube's head of content and business operations, who states that the service will start blocking music videos from labels that haven't signed on to its new terms in a matter of days. So this, of course, caused a massive uproar in the industry. Everybody's up in arms wondering what's going to happen. And nobody actually thought that YouTube was going to go through with it and actually start pulling videos from independent labels. And nobody actually knows what pulling means at this point. You know, I woke up this morning with the realization that it's going to be very difficult for YouTube to actually start pulling stuff completely down. It might maybe halt monetization of the videos, but actually pulling it would really put it in the crosshairs of regulators, both in the US and in Europe, especially where regulators are pretty go down pretty hard on this kind of behaviors by monopolistic enterprises, essentially. And you know, so many points of view to look at. For example, I was listening to the Daily Tech News show by Tom Merritt yesterday, and he made a really good point saying that the company may invalidate its safe harbor status in the US by blocking content on its platform for no valid reason, essentially. And finally, Vivo's status is also a question mark. We don't know what's going to happen to that content. The company, Vivo, states that they are still going to have those videos on YouTube if they're going through them, but really it's a question mark there. So, you know, really, what are your thoughts? You know, Dan, you're in San Francisco. What's the sort of latest around there in the music community as an independent label? Do you feel like YouTube is going to go through with this, or is it just insane? What's happening?
They certainly are acting like they're going to go through with it. I'm not sure why they would even threaten to do this unless they were planning on taking action, because this isn't exactly a popular statement, as you say. I've heard this referred to in a couple different places as a declaration of war, Yeah. Now that might be a bit of hyperbole, but I can see the logic there. This is something that's going to hit. You know, they say it's about 10% of indie labels, but includes some big ones. It includes XL, includes Domino. So this means that we're going to be, if they go through with it, and if the regulators allow them to go through with it, it means we're, you know, Radiohead videos might be disappearing. It means that there's issues. It's a thornier, and like you say, which videos even get taken down, I think, exactly. It's open to debate. Take something like Adele, which is on XL in the UK and Columbia in the States. So are her videos taken down in the UK only, or are they kept up in the States? I mean, it's a bit of a logistical minefield, and it's a very aggressive action on YouTube's part.
Yeah.
I have to assume that they... spoke amongst themselves and crunched the numbers and decided that it was important enough to them to get labels on board for this new paid service that they're going to be launching.
Yeah.
So important that they're essentially prepared to use the nuclear option on labels who aren't willing to go along.
Yeah, absolutely. And Duncan, you know, what are your thoughts, considering that you've also covered the space for a number of years? And, this seems like a really strange fight to pick, because independents are going to stir emotions. You know, if they pick the same fights with the majors, I don't think people would have had the same reaction. But because independents are involved, I think there's going to be a huge uproar here.
I mean, like you said in the introduction to this story, this is something that we don't actually know a whole lot about yet, especially the mechanics of the whole situation, how this is going to work. At the moment, it seems to be just a lot of bluster and loud noises. But what I think is interesting in a kind of placing it within this kind of historical context is that you don't often see Google playing hardball quite so publicly. They often like to cultivate a very, very kind of fluffy, nice, warm, everybody be friends image.
Yeah.
And they're not really doing this. And partly you could say that's because it's the indies that dragged this out into the open about a month ago with that angry letter, and then more recently. But it's very rare to see Google not then try and make some public steps to calm things down.
Right.
It's an odd situation, and I'm kind of surprised.
Yeah, I'm surprised too, because I thought, at one point, I thought surely like the quote was misstated and there's going to be a correction coming from YouTube soon around what actually was said in the Financial Times piece and what they actually meant. But now, you know, over 24 hours later, we haven't had any retraction or correction from YouTube. And so that's kind of weird.
Yeah, they seem to be quite happy to just see what happens for the time being, which, I mean, may be the best policy. I mean, they may be waiting to gauge what the public reaction is to this. I mean, you say it's going to kind of stir emotions. I think maybe not as many as it would have done, say, 5 years ago.
Right.
Because there are, you know, a lot of these indie artists are quite big. But I think that they sort of sit alongside the majors very, very much now in a way that perhaps they didn't used to.
Yeah. I mean, I take exception to the percentage that was presented as well, because I was at a Merlin keynote of Charles Caldas at the AIM Music Connected Day just a couple of months ago, and he was talking about the fact that, independent labels have a 30+% it was 32, I think, market share when it comes to digital I think it was in the US, but I just have to double check on
that. Is that in terms of downloads or streams or YouTube
views? I think it was
overall
digital market share for the independents. And here, you know, we're seeing the statement saying that they have 90% of labels on board and 10% are not. But then if all of the labels that are represented by AIM and all the other independent bodies worldwide are on the same boat and are making a united front on this, then I can't understand how they can claim that they have 90% of the content or of the labels on board. It doesn't add up.
No, definitely. I think one of the dangers here is that this isn't just inside baseball. This is something that will affect fans and consumers as well.
Right.
And, you know, the rest of the world, aside from this slightly rarefied music industry, doesn't necessarily care too much about royalties and percentages. But when you're a 14-year-old and you want to go and watch your new favorite video and you go onto YouTube and it's blocked, I think we're going to, I think we're in danger of seeing an uproar from fans and consumers as well. I'll say that if I were Vimeo right now, I'd be meeting in my war room to make plans and see how we could capitalize on this.
Yeah,
sure, absolutely. But I mean, I think in the situation you just described, where a 14-year-old goes and finds that his favorite video isn't on YouTube, the first place he heads is the Pirate Bay. It's not, he doesn't get angry. He just goes and downloads it somewhere else, which doesn't give any money to the fans at all, to the bands at all.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, the other thing that YouTube could do, again, in the realm of speculations, would be to remove access to the monetization features and leave the videos up there, which would hurt the bands equally as much and probably force them to pull the video, but maybe wouldn't come, you know, wouldn't run into the same regulatory hurdles that it might run into if it actually actively removes the video because they don't want to accept their terms.
I think if they remove sort of tools like Content ID from the labels as well alongside this stuff, then that would really erode their argument big time, because then that casts them very much as a company that doesn't respect copyright at all, if you take away tools for the labels to protect themselves in that way.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. I mean, again, we're speculating here. We've seen some strong statements from the Indie Music Week conference by Rich Bengloff, the president of A2IM, who sort of backs up the indie position that YouTube is not playing by the rules here, or playing fairly. And we'll see what happens next week, I'm sure. We might have to open up with this story once again, because it's probably... one of the biggest stories of the year after Apple buying Beats, actually probably bigger than Apple buying Beats in actual terms. Second story of the day, we have to talk about Amazon. Of course, Amazon has launched its new music streaming service after a few months of rumors, and people were kind of going back and forth as to whether this was going to happen or not, but it actually did happen. And the Amazon decided to launch with a limited catalog. They couldn't get everybody on board. They're only featuring slightly older content, 6 months old or older, and they don't have Universal Music on board, which is a pretty bold choice considering that most streaming services out there consider Universal Music to be sort of the first port of call when they're trying to get blanket licenses on content. And you know, it's going to be available to Prime subscribers in the US who pay $99 per year, and they also get, you know, the 2-day free delivery in the US, access to the video, instant video service, and the Kindle book loan program. And so music is just a small part of this, 1 million tracks as opposed to, you know, the 15, 20 millions on other services, and a limited catalog. So what do you guys think? Do you think that this can catch on even with its limited scope, or are users just going to be turned off by the fact that they can't find the latest hits on the service? Dan?
I think that by their own admission, this service isn't really designed to appeal to hardcore music fans. I think the idea here, as you say, it's not really just about music. It's about adding value to a program that already exists with the free delivery and the videos and so on. You know, Amazon has this catalog. You can't really argue that the catalog is as good as the other streaming services, because objectively it isn't.
Yeah.
But the point is, for people who haven't gotten on board with Spotify, who aren't necessarily going to go and pay to download music on iTunes, but they like to listen to something in the background, they like to go and listen to their favorite record from 5 years ago, it's just, to me, it's added value to... It's not really the centerpiece. It's icing on the cake, as I see it. And as such, I think it's a smart idea. This is not going to be this won't be the iTunes killer. And I don't think it's necessarily trying to be. I think it's Amazon just trying to use everything that they have in their arsenal to build as strong of an offering as possible.
Yeah.
That being said, Universal not being part of the catalog is... That's a major omission. Yeah, that's not a small thing.
Yeah.
But I think they figured that something is better than nothing.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting. You know, it's definitely good to see one large company that decides to go without Universal's catalog, and then we can see what the public's reaction is, because they have such a huge you know, percentage of the marketplace these days. And so I wanted to ask you, Duncan, some headlines actually said, Amazon opens the biggest on-demand streaming music service in the US because they already have 11 million Prime subscribers. Is that sort of a misrepresentation of what this actually is, given that users haven't asked for it or are not specifically
paying
for it?
Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, you've got to ask yourself what percentage of those users are actually going to start using this. And,
yeah.
and I imagine it's going to be probably below 50%, probably significantly below 50%. I think, to be honest, I don't have an awful lot to add to what Dan said, but I will say that I think in about a month, we'll all have forgotten that Amazon has a streaming music service.
That's a bold prediction. And it's going to be interesting. I mean,
until they get Universal on board anyway, and then we'll report on it again and then forget again.
Probably. I mean, talking about Amazon, actually, they are about in 15 minutes time, they are supposedly going to announce a new phone.
Yeah, 3D.
So that's definitely not music related. But if they do bundle music into the phone experience, then maybe there's something there for the streaming service on top of everything else.
That's possible. And that could drive more users. But Dan is absolutely right. This is just a gambit to try and get a few more Prime users or to persuade people that are sitting on the fence thinking, is this worth it? Oh, yeah, we get some music. Yeah, go on then. Let's pay.
Especially as they raise the price by $20 as of this month or last month. Used to be $79 and now it's $99, so still not
yeah
very
so
much.
They're in this war trying to convince people that it's worth money, and some people are going to be persuaded, surely.
The music is almost a loss leader for them, I think.
Exactly.
I don't think they're not necessarily looking to change the game. They're looking to entice some new customers who, like Duncan said, who are on the fence.
Yeah
There's no innovation.
I think it's a smart move. I mean, why not do it if you have that catalog?
And I mean,
and in that situation, you don't need Universal or anything. It's just it's just a bit of extra music. Yeah,
but it feels like it's kind of weird because we've been talking for years now on DNT about the fact that music doesn't really move the needle that much. But then again, this year we're really seeing a call to arms by all the major companies to try and position themselves in the music space as somebody that has a presence and that can sort of hold their own with consumers. So, you know, but why, as a more general, point, why do you think that is? Do you think that's because the music is going to drive engagement and retention and therefore is more valuable than we've been thinking over the last couple of years when we, sort of thinking, oh, okay, there's a music edition, but it's not going to make the difference? Or is it just the fact that they are trying anything to find a differentiating point than competitors at this point?
I think they've probably been trying to sign the deals for 2 years and they've only just now managed it.
I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case, actually. Yeah, because the first rumors came probably late last year about this. It's kind of an interesting thing going on. We're seeing so many different companies move into the space. We're seeing Google apparently also interested in purchasing internet radio services with 8 tracks, an offer on 8 tracks, and now potentially an offer on Songza. So really a lot of hard positioning from big companies to try and get a big stake in the music space, and we don't really know why yet.
It's good news at the end of the day, because more competition in the market is good, and more innovation in the market is good. And I mean, Spotify has been, I think, a really great positive force. I think possibly Dan might disagree with me there. I don't know what your position is on that. But some people would disagree with that. But I think it has been a really, really positive force for getting more people to listen to more music all over the world.
Yeah. Dan, do you agree with that?
And the more of that there is in the world, the more services there are doing that, the better.
As a fan, I love Spotify. As a music consumer, which in many ways is what I am first and foremost, I think Spotify and RDO and the streaming services are the greatest things since sliced bread. I mean, it's hard not to enjoy them. There's a but. I mean, as a label, of course, I would like to see. I would let you know. I see the royalty reports when they come in, and I see that they can be slender. Would be a generous way to put it for a small indie label. And I think we're still. I think everyone on both sides is trying to negotiate a solution to that. But it may just be trying to square the circle. It may just not be doable.
Can I ask a question, Dan?
Sure.
Did you ever sort of monitor at any point the piracy levels of your musicians' work?
I monitored it sort of subjectively. I mean, I could see I would, you know, I would go and search. I never hired, you know, there are certain companies that will actually, you can hire them and they will issue takedown notices and scour the web. And I didn't, to be frank, I didn't really have the resources to do that. But certainly when I put out a popular record, you know, a little bit of Googling, you know, within about 5 minutes, you can see how readily available your stuff is. And, you know, to translate that into, well, how many sales am I losing? It's risky business there. The math gets fuzzy because it's not that every single person who's illegally downloading your record is someone who otherwise, in the absence of that download link, would be going and buying it. Yeah, some people just, they're mildly interested and they say, okay, I'll give this a listen. There's nothing to lose.
Yeah.
So I monitored it. And I mean, there's no doubt that, I mean, I think it, by this point in 2014, it's pretty inarguable that piracy damages sales. I don't think, I think the verdict is in on that one. But in terms of putting an exact number on it, I'd be reluctant to do so.
Yeah.
Okay. No, I'm just curious because, I mean, my impression is that Spotify has, more than anything else, has killed piracy in any significant way. I don't know anybody among my circle of friends who still pirates music in any way whatsoever since the arrival of Spotify.
I agree with you. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, considering that piracy, you know, I shouldn't say most because there's plenty of sort of casual fans doing it, but, you know, any hardcore music fan who's going to go and steal these things or download them illegally, if they can find them easily and legally and cheaply or free on Spotify or one of the other streaming services, I think they will.
Yeah.
And you know, in that sense, as a label, my attitude is better to get some royalty than no royalty at all.
Yeah, and hopefully, like in the next few months, I mean, Spotify started on that, but you're going to start getting some more data as well on who's consuming it and where and why, which is...
That'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you're talking about piracy, and, of course, the guys at BitTorrent would hate me to tag the story afterwards, but it kind of seems like a natural segue at this point. And BitTorrent announced the latest numbers around its bundles initiative, and they've reached 100 million downloads and streams since the initiative's launch, which happened in May 2013. That was so it's been a little over a year, pretty successful. You know, they've grown by 1,095% in users, monthly users since May of last year, with it reaching 25 million users per month, and return rates are very impressive, 75%, and 25% of visitors share the content within their networks. So overall, it seems like a pretty rosy picture, and also they had artists involved from Moby to Diplo to Lee Scratch Perry, Madonna, Public Enemy, and Amanda Palmer. Lots of different artists and filmmakers involved in the initiative. But I kind of wanted to go back to the idea of revenues, because one of the things that struck me around the blog post that the company published is the fact that they talk about the fact that, for example, Netflix doesn't have a catalog big enough to be sustainable for smaller independent filmmakers because they don't have enough movies on there. And YouTube doesn't pay enough. You know, YouTube pays around $1,750 per million streams, which of course varies by artist and by depending on who you're using for monetization. Painting this picture of these services not being sustainable, but at the same time, I haven't yet seen the bundles being used effectively for monetizing something. The two-tier bundle is the second tier is unlocked via an email address or by doing a social action. I haven't come across many bundles that have a payment option, which is possible, but hasn't been implemented really. So my question is, like, where can BitTorrent take this next? People are using these, they are downloading them. Can artists actually start making money out of them? Duncan, what do you reckon?
Well, I mean, this is a promotional tool at the end of the day. This is about getting more people to listen to music. It's not about making money in the same way that putting a track on SoundCloud isn't about making money. It's about getting it out there and getting it heard by lots of people.
Yeah.
And from the stats that you've been citing and that BitTorrent has reported, it seems like that has been a tremendously successful thing to do. It would be interesting to see someone try and charge for it. I don't think it will necessarily be that successful, but then that's not what BitTorrent is really built for. BitTorrent is a tool to share something as far and wide as quickly and efficiently as possible and make it continually available always.
Yeah.
You know, your website can't crash because you're getting it not off a website, you're getting it off a million people around the world. So it's an incredibly effective tool at doing what it does, but that tool needs to be used in the right way. You know, I think in a way asking if artists can make money on this is kind of a bit like saying, can you, you know, use a screwdriver to bash a nail into the wall? It's not really what it's designed to do.
Yeah. I mean, I totally get it, and I totally agree with you. The one thing that I was questioning was, why did they open the blog post by talking about the money that artists are making from YouTube and the, you know, Netflix and stuff? It just seemed like,
yeah, that was a little odd. I'll give you that.
No, it was a well written blog post, and clearly written by, you know, an intelligent team of people. So you have to assume that if they're not talking about the amount of money that's been brought in, that's not an accidental oversight. That's right. An intentional omission.
Yeah,
I have to tip my hat to BitTorrent. I mean, 100 million downloads is a lot. That's impressive, and the fact that they got it, you know, somewhere in the area of 9 million. For Mobi alone, I mean, that's impressive, and you know, frankly, you know, any of these services that gains traction deserves to be applauded, because it gives them a little more leeway to play around and experiment in the future. But like Duncan says, I think this is for the artists involved, and it's not just artists, because there's films and, you know, there's other things. Yeah. But for the purposes of our conversation, we can talk about music. I think it works as a promotional tool.
Yeah.
And actually, in an interesting way, I think it works as a promotional tool for BitTorrent, which is a company that is, I think, trying to rehabilitate their image a little bit. I mean, you said that they would dislike it if you opened this conversation, but, you know, by tagging it with piracy. And I think you're absolutely right. I think they would dislike it. And I think this is their attempt to go legitimate.
Yeah.
And as such, I think they're doing a really good job with it. Where you go from here, how you monetize it for the artists and how BitTorrent monetizes it for themselves, I think, is an open question. I'm not sure if we've seen the answer to it yet.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's been, it's only been in 13 months, so it's definitely still in the experimental stage, but I would love to see an experiment on a large scale with one of the big artists to see if people are actually going to pay for this and how much. And moving on, I'm getting more and more confused by Samsung's strategy when it comes to digital music. So the company, of course,
it has a strategy.
it's a huge company, so it can't, that has to be said. They have so many different divisions, but after announcing a partnership with Deezer in Europe with the release of their latest handsets, so you get 6 months free of Deezer Premium. After doing that, and after launching Milk, South by Southwest, which is their internet radio service, which also now includes some premium tiers, and that's the US only, the company also announced last week the integration with Spotify, but only for its new line of wireless speakers called Series M. And so essentially they integrated the Spotify Connect technology that was announced earlier in 2013 and hasn't actually been used by a whole lot of manufacturers yet. It hasn't really taken off in any significant way, because I keep looking for speakers that have this integrated and come up pretty short. They only have a very few models that have them. Samsung announced this, and they will be the first speakers to actually allow Spotify Connect to work across multiple speakers simultaneously. Spotify Connect, actually, I should point out, allows users to pass the signal of the track they're playing on from their phone onto the speaker, but it actually pulls, the speaker actually starts pulling the track from the cloud instead of pulling it from the device, so you're not tied to spatial issues or Bluetooth issues or any of that kind of stuff, and it should be, it's pretty seamless from the looks of it. So I don't know, Dan, how do you feel this can compete with the likes of Sonos? I mean, obviously that's a target here, and do you reckon that it makes sense for Spotify Connect to continue growing, or is the fact that it's so tied out to hardware going to be a pretty hard sell for other manufacturers?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't have a strong opinion on this topic.
Right.
I think in some ways, I think it's a bit of a non-news item in the sense that, as I understand it, I mean, you know, there's already so many wireless speakers out there. The fact, you know, Sonos and Jambox and so on, that, you know, this feels like a little bit
absolutely
too late to be groundbreaking news. I think it's cool. I think it's a way for Spotify to sort of show off this technology that they've developed. And as such, I think it's cool. But I'm not sure why this news would make... I don't think it would make me run out and buy these speakers. I already have a pair of wireless speakers that I can play anything on my phone or on my laptop. That being said, I haven't used the speakers. And, you know, if the functionality is really strong and it works in such a way that there's no danger of the signal cutting out, you know, I mean, I know that the Bluetooth can be a little... It can be a little wonky if I'm streaming from my phone to a wireless speaker on the other end of the room and I walk too far away with my phone, it's game over.
It cuts off, yeah, exactly.
So the thought of having a wireless speaker that can stream Spotify and is pulling it from the cloud and therefore you don't have to be too concerned about your own positioning with regard to the speaker, it's a nice thing. I don't necessarily see it as a game changer.
I'm actually waiting for my gramophone to be delivered next month at some point. They should start shipping them. So we'll see how that works against other types of wireless streaming consumption. Duncan, do you use Sonos? What do you use?
I used to use Sonos a lot. Now I tend to just listen to headphones plugged into my laptop more than anything else on my phone. it's old school, I know, but it works and it sounds nice. What I think's missing in a lot of this hardware discussion around streaming music to these things is a kind of central standard that can just be used by everybody. I mean, you've got Spotify Connect, as you say. Apple has AirTunes or whatever it's called. AirPlay, sorry. Google has got sort of Chromecast, even though that's more sort of focused around video. It also obviously does audio. There's no kind of one central thing that everybody can hook into. All of these music streaming services and all of these bits of hardware and just make them talk to each other nicely. Yeah. And having that in place would be really nice. It would make it so much easier for everybody and better for consumers.
Yeah, and it's going to be so tough to see a standard come up from that because these companies just relish siluses. So
yeah, absolutely. And for consumers, it just becomes confusing. And so nobody wants to jump in because then you get format wars and it's fine. I'm not terribly excited about the news.
I'm not terribly excited. I just wanted to point it out because it was just funny to think, for example, you know, a European consumer buying a Samsung phone with a Deezer subscription and then getting the speaker that currently only works with Spotify and doesn't actually work with Deezer.
Yeah. I mean, Samsung is so big that the fingers don't know what the thumb is doing, let alone the shoulder or the ankle or something. Yeah.
There's not a lot of internal consistency to the business decisions.
Exactly, it makes sense. And I just wanted to introduce a quick interview that I made recorded last night with the company Sidestep. I read an interesting feature on them on Pando Daily, and you know, they are a startup focusing on improving the experience of acquiring merchandise at gigs. So I thought I'd get in touch with the founder and let you know what that's all about. So here it is. And it's a real pleasure today to welcome to the show Eric Jones, the CEO of the company Sidestep. So hi, Eric, and thanks for joining us. How's it going?
Of course. Great. How you doing?
Great, it's great to have you. And so I want to hear a little bit more about the company. Of course, I read the Pando Daily article about your launch and the increase of this Fall Out Boy merchandise contract. But first of all, what is Sidestep all about?
So Sidestep is a way that you can browse and buy concert merchandise over your phone for either pickup or delivery. So if you're going to a show 2 weeks from now, you can open up the app and see what the artist is selling, buy your items, choose the show, and pick it up at the show in a shorter line.
That's great. And so when did the company set out?
We released our beta in September 2013, so about 11 months ago, and our new iOS app just came out last week.
How many bands have you worked with so far, and what's your aim in terms of level? Are you working mainly with smaller or medium artists, or are you open just to bigger artists?
Right now we work with about 15 artists. We're trying to take it slow just to, you know, just make sure that everything's working really well and the app is, you know, of high quality and the on-site experience is really good for users that use the app.
Of course.
But we have some partnerships that are forming with other merchandise companies right now and other pretty cool partners. So slowly starting in the fall, we're going to expand a lot more.
That's great. And you work with a couple of great artists. So you work with the Downtown Fiction. And those are sort of in the middle tier, I guess, of a popular act, but not megastars. And you also work with Fall Out Boy. So how did those two experiences differ in terms of fulfillment and volumes?
Yeah. So we're trying to focus more on the mostly higher tier artists.
Right.
I think Sidestep would be used best in those situations at those bigger venues. But we'd like to try with mid-tier artists as well, just to see, different tests to see if, you know, for example, if Fall Out Boy is on the app and then the user buys from Indian Lakes, for example, another smaller artist, we like to see cross sales where, you know, it shows that people are viewing other stores, and if they like Fall Out Boy, maybe they'll like Many Legs. And as the app continues to grow, we're going to try to get smarter and smarter and actually curate artists for users.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, talking about Fall Out Boy, how did you start working with them? How did that come about?
Yeah, so lead investor in Sidestep actually owns a merchandise company called Manhead Merchandise, and they work directly with Crush Management, and Crush is the manager to Fall Out Boy, Panic at the Disco, Trey. And so it's been a huge, huge connection, huge help to getting us started.
From there, actually, you are moving on to working on their entire tour for U.S. tour for the next few months. So, how are you planning on that? And how, you know, is that going to be a massive nightmare, or is it just a scaling of the same platform and it should be relatively manageable?
Yeah, I mean, we're doing three tours this summer. The first one's Fall Out Boy. Yeah. We're doing Panic the Disco, then Magnificent and Gavin DeGraw. And we're just trying to use each tour as its own separate test to make sure the on-site experience is awesome. The app is running really well. So logistically, I think it's going to run very smoothly. You know, we're bringing a new technology into venues that haven't had something like this really in a long time. I think the most innovation has been Square. The credit card unit for local sellers. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how people react to Sidestep from the crew to the venues, to the fans. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And so talking about that, like actually one of the things that's interesting is that, of course, people can browse the products beforehand, but also perhaps you can also pair it up with the support act that generally doesn't sell anywhere near as much as the main band. But this way, maybe people are going to be able to get to know the support act before they actually go to the venue, which would be quite nice.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the most exciting part is we're seeing, which I mentioned before, bigger artists in the same card. Products from Fall Out Boy, you know, From Any Length is in the same card, and you know, so it just shows that people are very curious about other artists, and with Sidestep they're discovering, you know, not only really good products from those artists, but also maybe the artists for the first time, which is really cool.
Yeah, of course, and you guys don't come into the fulfillment of it. It's purely a service, so essentially you don't compete with any of the merch providers. It's more a case of acting as an intermediary in order to allow the fulfillment of the sales and the pre-order of the items.
Exactly, and I think more so than that, we are also supplying the merch companies with new data they haven't had before, where if we go live with Fall Out Boy's merchandise 2 weeks before the tour starts, we can see, you know, the top markets, the top items, which size is going to sell in a certain market, and all this data can be used to make better tour projections and just to have your tour business in line better. So it's definitely really exciting for the merch companies.
That's fantastic. And Eric, thanks so much for your time, and we'll keep an eye on Sidestep.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Appreciate
Cheers.
It.
Thank and you. We're back. And so, Duncan, do you reckon that this is something that you would use if you were going to gig and you could order merchandise in advance and not have to queue or not have to, you know, find out that your size extra, extra large or extra, extra small is sold out?
It's a pretty neat concept. I like the idea, the concept. It's not something I've heard of before. It's pretty original. But I guess the difficulty would be making sure the fans know that it's available, because I think a lot of people just show up at gigs without, you know, thinking too much about it other than we're going to see a band. They're not going to look for an app or anything in advance. There would have to be pretty clear communication that you can do this. And even then, a lot of people might not actually want to buy a t-shirt until they've seen the band or something like that, or seen the iTunes in question.
See the t-shirt.
Yeah, exactly. So, but then on the other hand, you know, online shopping for clothes has been tremendously successful. So maybe it will work out just fine. I hope it does. I think it's a neat idea.
Yeah, it's a good idea. They seem to have done pretty well with Fall Out Boy, and they've extended the contract with them. So it's an exciting, interesting startup. And Dan, on your front, how are your bands handling merchandise these days? It's a topic that I'm quite interested in, because from South By onwards, I've seen that there's more and more companies trying to break the merch sort of disaster loop, which is, you know, a fairly inefficient system right now in the US especially.
Absolutely, it is. I mean, I first of all, I think this app is a great idea. I think it will be of somewhat limited use. I don't see this as you know, changing the entire landscape, but that's no slight on it. I think it makes sense, especially for larger artists who do sell out of their merch. Although, of course, you know, it also begs the question: why aren't bands being a little more logical about planning their merch out? Right? If you're selling out of your size extra large, show after show after show, you should bring some more extra large t-shirts. I think the the best thing that's happened to band merch or to enabling bands to sell their merch at shows is you know the wireless you know credit card technology, Square, right. and things like that. I mean that yeah. that's been a game changer, and almost every band that I know brings that along on tour because having been a merch guy in my younger years, it can be maddening when you have a swarm of people you know rushing at you, thrusting $20 bills in your face and making change, and it can be problematic.
Yeah.
Especially if you've had a couple drinks.
and as far as like services that are being used, you know, have you seen anything come up or being people switch into that? Given that Topspin now has been incorporated in another company, and maybe people might want to move on to the different services. What you know, have you got any feelers on that, and what bands are choosing right now?
I mean, I still think that the best way to sell merch is, I mean, it can be done more efficiently. I think you're right that there are gross inefficiencies in how it's done. But I think the majority of merchandise purchases are impulse purchases.
Right.
It's someone at the show. It's an opening band. They've never seen them before. They're impressed and they want to walk home with the CD. I mean, frankly, that's probably where you see the most physical product being sold. It's just yeah. people right there in the moment saying, "Wow, this is great. I want to," you know, the band said on stage that they're selling their CDs and they need gas money to get to the next town. Sure, I'm going to go buy that. I'm going to go buy a t-shirt. I like the idea for this app. It does make me wonder if people are going to take the time ahead of time to log onto yeah. the app, purchase and reserve a merchandise item, why they couldn't just as easily just go, assuming the band has a Topspin store or some sort of, you know, online consumer-facing shop, why they couldn't just buy it right there and then and yeah. not have to deal with picking it up at the show at all.
Yeah.
But, you know, so the only, not flaw necessarily, but the only drawback I see in this app is that I think it presumes that people are think about this before they get to the show. And right. I'm not sure that they do. I think it's a, for a lot of people, I think it's a fairly impulsive behavior.
Yeah.
That being said, I think it's a cool app. I wish it all the best. I'd love to see it succeed. And anything that that helps artists sell more merch and helps fans get the things that they want, I mean, it's a good thing. There's not much to criticize there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, it's a good thing. And so talking about, I wanted to move on to talk about money. So we've seen, I mean, I want to cover this briefly because there's not really a huge amount to say here, but it's worth mentioning that French music streaming service Deezer has had a new injection of cash courtesy of German media entity ProSiebenSat.1, which is a very user-friendly name. So the amount of the investment has not been officially disclosed. It's been reported as being in the region of $150 million. And it adds to the money already raised by Deezer, and that takes a total to about $300 million, which is a pretty neat amount, just a couple hundred millions below what Spotify has raised so far, as far as I remember. And Deezer has been gearing up for launch in the United States this year, and nobody really understands how they will launch, in the sense that there doesn't seem to be a lot of space left in that market unless they manage to pull out of the hat an amazing partnership. I mean, I know that, for example, Verizon hasn't got a really steady partner on streaming. I know they have some stuff going with Rhapsody, but nothing major, and they're the second operator in the US. And also we haven't seen Time Warner Cable or Comcast take sides on that. So if Deezer could snag one of those as a partner, that could be pretty interesting. But you know, what do you guys make of the fundraise, but especially you know, for you, Dan, and also Duncan, from an outside perspective, what do you think of their potential entry into the US? Is there any way to get into this market now without a huge partner?
Dan?
No. obviously this is great news for Deezer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anytime you get an infusion of cash, it expands your options. I think that's fantastic. And I think you're absolutely right that their strategy, not that I'm privy to it, but to me the smart money is that any strategy for launching in the States has to include having some really strong partners right out of the box. I know that one of Deezer's selling points is that a higher percentage of their users are paying. that being said, I'm not sure how that would necessarily translate into success in the States, because if they're launching in this market, there's no real reason to assume, unless they have really have an ace up their sleeves, that consumer behavior is going to be radically different for Deezer than it's been for Spotify and Beats and RDO and so on. I do wonder. I mean, I agree with what Duncan said earlier that, you know, more competition is always better. Yeah. And I would welcome. I'm excited for the day that Deezer launches in the States. But I do wonder if maybe they've just, you know, if that ship has sailed, perhaps. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, the market is consolidating so quickly, and it seems like there's less and less space to really make a name for yourself. And I think for consumers, just having one more option, I don't know. I've thought about this a lot. I'm very curious to see what Deezer does.
Yeah,
next.
They have to come in with a splash of some sort. I don't know what it
absolutely.
Can be, what it will be, but yeah. Duncan?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have an awful lot to add to that. I think if I were Deezer, I wouldn't be chasing after America at all. I would just regard that as something to think about later if they get the opportunity to, if they're lucky enough to get the opportunity to. I think if it were me, I would probably be shooting at like emerging markets. I'd be looking at, you know, South America, and I'd be looking at Africa and parts of Southeast Asia. I think that would be a much smarter strategy for them to look at if they're looking for global expansion rather than just consolidating and fighting off Spotify in the territories that they're in at the moment, which I imagine they're having difficulty enough doing as it is.
My assumption is that even in France, they hardly have a stranglehold on the market.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, you're right that fighting a war on too many fronts, well, I mean, you know, having this new investment, it gives them a bigger war chest, and it allows them to pursue more of a multi-pronged strategy. So it doesn't necessarily have to be one or the other. But you know, it's not like Spotify isn't, you know, growing into emerging markets as well.
Yeah.
So that's not virgin territory either, of course.
I mean, Deezer is interesting because they are in the most territories of any other service. I think they listed as 180 plus territories. Also, they have taken particular care of doing little things. Like I was talking to I did the Brazilian show last week, and they told me that Deezer is the only service in Brazil that accepts local currency, which means that people that don't have international credit cards can actually pay for it. Whilst with Spotify, it's only an international credit cards deal, which restricts the entire service to only 5% of the population of Brazil that can actually pay for the service. So that's a problem.
That's an interesting point, yeah.
So that's a problem. So if they have taken care of doing stuff like that in other territories, then they definitely have a leg up. And you know, as far as the story is concerned, I should point out that ProSiebenSat.1 has also another service called Ampia that is going to be rolled into Deezer, so they're going to get those users as well. And it has a deal with Vodafone in Germany that will be taken over there by Deezer, so that's definitely some good news for the service in Germany. And it's just a case of seeing where that money ends up, really, because if they plan on spending the vast majority of it in the States, it just seems like a huge gamble for a market that is already difficult, and we've seen how much money Beats has spent, and even with their huge partnership with AT&T and with their brand name and everything else, they've had a really hard time getting started. So we shall see what happens on that front. And I want to the next big news, the last big news I guess of the day, is Spotify. So Spotify has announced the fulfillment of one of the promises that they made at the South by Southwest developer meetup that I attended in March, which was the launch of an expanded and improved API, which is an application programming interface for people in the audience that might have heard about this term before. It's essentially a way for apps to communicate with one another and exchange data. So the new web API will allow applications to query the Spotify catalog and users' playlists through HTTP requests, and will allow developers to pull data like album artwork, 30 seconds previews of tracks, top tracks per artist and per country, album genres, and a whole lot more. And also it will allow web APIs to web applications to actually create playlists on the go, directly on the application, and sync them with the user's account thanks to a new system of authorizations and approvals. So, you know, this has been received really well, and it seems to be also a a direct result of the Spotify's acquisition of the Echonest, because some of the changes have been illustrated by Paul Lemire as being brought by the fact that they extended the Echonest integration with Spotify, and they created this sort of Spotify Rosetta Stone database, which was the Echonest's project to allow cross-platform integrations or cross-platform IDs to be able to connect different services across the board. So this is all very complicated, and I'm sure I haven't done it justice. It's just such a complicated story to tell. But essentially, you know, it just seems like a good way for Spotify to increase its presence as a platform, increase the goodwill towards the developers and developers using Spotify as the base for their apps and services, and thus expanding essentially the Spotify ecosystem everywhere. Since most of these services can only be accessed if you're a premium subscriber, you know, it drives people to subscribing to the service. Duncan, what do you make of this? You know, of course, you're more hooked up to the developer community in terms of feeds and stuff. It seemed like the reaction was really positive all the way around.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be brilliant. It's not brilliant yet, but it is going to be brilliant, because basically what Spotify is doing here is giving developers the tools to make really, really cool things for people who listen to music.
Yeah, that's the easy
they're making
way
it way easier for people to build awesome web apps that pick its awesome things out of Spotify's database and mix it up in really cool ways and then put it in the ears of consumers. And that is why it's great. I don't think your average music listener kind of needs to worry a lot of the time about APIs and things like that. But that is, at the end of the day, what it is. It's Spotify being more open, being more accessible to programmers, and really, really cool things are going to come out of it, no doubt. I have no doubt about that.
Yeah. Dan, how's the temperature in San Francisco around sort of the community around Spotify's move into becoming a platform, or rather, you know, like a reference point for a backbone for the music industry online? Do you think that's something that's welcomed by the majority of people?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, what's not to like about it? I think it's. I mean, you know, I couldn't code if you put a gun to my head. So
right.
for me personally, this is it's not good news or bad news so much as irrelevant news. But I think for I mean, this is clearly it's evidence that Spotify's acquisition of Echonest is starting to bear fruit.
Yeah.
And I think it's a sign that, you know, I think it was generally hailed as a smart move when they did it, and I think it continues to seem to be a smart move. And I do think some neat stuff's going to come out of this, certainly for developers to be able to sort of piggyback on Spotify, which is this very, you know, popular platform. And there's some cool stuff. I was reading about this road trip mixtape app that lets you as you're driving, and you know, you can listen to bands from the city that you're driving through.
Yeah.
That's something, you know, the next time I take a road trip, I think I'll try that out. I mean, it's there's some neat ideas, and certainly opening that API up to developers is a positive thing. And the Rosetta Stone, in as much as I understand it, which is I don't claim to have a complete understanding of it, but you know, the fact that it allows these track IDs and lyric IDs to sort of pull from different services is a good thing, because anyone who's ever dealt with metadata and IDs knows that it gets hairy really quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only negative about how Rosetta Stone has evolved is the fact that at the beginning it was going to be a database that was going to cross over multiple streaming services as well as all the other types of services related to music. Now it kind of feels like that's probably fallen down the wayside, just because, of course, now the company is owned by Spotify, so it wouldn't make sense for them to offer a way for users to share tracks across different streaming services if, you know, they don't want to. So
exactly, that's Spotify getting their value.
So that's the only negative part of this.
I mean, when they it is, you know, arguably a negative for consumers, and it's a positive for Spotify.
Exactly,
and I think that's why they purchased Echonest, because if they have Echonest, then no one else can have it.
Yeah. But that's not something that's not replicable. I mean, I think it's something that is replicable, and there are companies that are working on doing this anyway. So it certainly doesn't restrict the market.
I don't know if I wholly agree with that. I mean, Echonest has been working on this for a long time, and they're very, very, very good at it. That level of expertise isn't matched anywhere else in the world, I would say, personally.
Yeah.
Yes, other people could do it, but it would take them a long time to get to the place where Echonest is today. And in the meantime, Echonest gets better and better and better. So
yeah.
I think it would be very difficult. Can I add one other thing about the Spotify thing? I think one thing that is very important to mention here is that Spotify is the only real streaming service that does this in any significant way, that has these kind of web APIs that lets music hackers kind of come in and build awesome stuff with people's music. And that is why they're winning. That's because they know that the freeing the music as much as possible, as much as the content creators will allow. I know that Spotify is constantly arguing to the content creators to just like open your hands a little bit, and people will make really, really cool things with this stuff. It's really, really good, and it's the reason why Spotify wins all the time, because their product is better.
I have to point out that Deezer has made a lot of efforts recently to get into that game over the last couple of years, but it just doesn't seem to be getting the same traction as Spotify has to this point. And of course, with the Echo Nest being now the backbone of the service, it becomes so much more developer friendly, because the Echo Nest know exactly what developers need, and they've been in that game for now 6 years, 7 years, and they really know their stuff. So even if the Spotify developers themselves may have put out an API that maybe was not as user as a developer friendly, the Echo Nest guys are going to be able to fix that pretty quick. So it's definitely a plus for Spotify there. And finally, I wanted to ask you, Duncan. I wanted to ask you about this Global Breakfast Radio article that you posted.
Oh yeah,
that sounds really fun.
It was awesome. It's these guys, a pair of artists. Their names escape me now. I don't suppose you've got them in front of you, do you?
No.
Sebamina and another chap. Anyway, they built an app that plays web radio from wherever it's breakfast in the world right now.
And Daniel Jones, sorry.
So you can always listen to breakfast radio from all over the world. So, and they've got all these amazing, they've got a list of 190 odd stations, all kinds of weird things like Umpa music from Bavaria, and then some like island in the middle of the Pacific where it's basically the only island in that time zone that has a radio station. And so they managed to kind of get their feed and everything, and they listen to all of these, and they curated this thing. And I was listening to it for about an hour the other day, and it went through kind of like there was this California Wine Valley radio thing where it was all the latest Wine Valley news. Some company had taken over some other company, and it was big news in this Wine Valley. And it was a fascinating look at just these little kind of microcosms all over the world. A really, really nice illustration of the power of local radio, actually.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And, amen to that. That's a great idea.
That's great.
It's fantastic.
And so is that automated or personally curated?
Yeah, they've automated it. Apparently, they're hand curating the list of stations, and they're updating it from time to time as things go on and offline. And they'll take suggestions. So if you have a particularly good breakfast show in your area, then you can send it to them, and they'll include it if they like it. But it's other than that, it's completely automatic.
Awesome, man.
That actually makes me think of something. I'm sort of tying it into our previous conversation. There was an app on Spotify, and I'm blanking on the name, but it came out about maybe 6 months ago or 9 months ago.
Right.
That randomly selects a track on Spotify that has never been listened to ever by anybody.
Right. Yeah.
Because there's so much unlistened to catalog, and I love any of these services that, I mean, of course, there's an element of randomness to it, but as a discovery tool for music or for even just for talk shows or new perspectives, I think things like that are fantastic, and I can see a lot of appeal to them.
Yeah, I should check out actually where they are on that and whether they are actually managed to get anywhere near having all the tracks to listen to. I mean, that's an unwinnable war, unfortunately, because there's thousands and thousands.
Probably
of
more gets added each day than can be listened to.
Yeah.
I suspect.
Exactly. So, but that was quite a fun project. It got a lot of press at the time, and that's pretty much it. Dan, anything too that you want to plug your end as far as the label is concerned, or anything else?
Well, I might give you a better Twitter handle to follow me at,
because
what goes up is virtually dormant.
Right. Sorry.
That's okay. Friendly at Friendly Fire Rec. Friendly Fire REC is my label and sync licensing company. And I'd encourage you all to check out a new Icelandic band I've been managing called Retro Stefson, who are really, really good.
Incredible band. I love that band.
Awesome! Yay! I love hearing that.
Yay! Everybody's happy.
I've seen them a few times in Iceland, and they're wonderful. I would definitely also recommend that everybody listening checks out Retro Stefson. Really, really fun band.
Yay!
I'll PayPal you your fee later on.
And Duncan again, and we I'm going to direct people to duncangear.com, and also if you do a search for Duncan Gear and Wired, you're going to find all the articles that Duncan's posted there in the last few weeks, which are great. There's a bunch of different things on music and on you know, environment, weather, all sorts of stuff. So that's awesome. And and yeah, that's pretty much it. Thanks so much for joining me on the show today. It was really great fun recording it, and there was so much stuff to cover. You can find everything on Digital Music Trends on the site, of course, digitalmusictrends.com. And don't forget to check out the DMT one-to-one shows, which cover interesting startups and interesting digital music projects. You can find the show pretty much everywhere. So if you've listened to this show as a one-off from YouTube, for example, you can also go and subscribe as a podcast, so downloads automatically, and you don't have to go and remember to go back to YouTube to listen to it. And you can, of course, follow the show on Twitter on @DGMusicTrends, or subscribe to the newsletter on bit.ly/DMTList. Thanks so much for listening. Have a fantastic week, and until next time.